Welcome to the Paleo View. I'm Stacey Toth of PaleoParents.com. You might also know me as the Broth Lady, or the inventor of the hashtag More Vegetables Than a Vegetarian. I'm the co-author of several paleo cookbooks, including Eat Like a Dinosaur, Beyond Bacon, and the upcoming Real Life Paleo. I like to talk about health at any size, and self-love, and personal acceptance. Specifically, I have a love for lifting heavy things. If you're interested in finding more out about that, you can also find me on Strong Woman Radio.
And I'm Dr. Sarah Ballantyne of ThePaleoMom.com. I'm the New York Times best-selling author of The Paleo Approach and The Paleo Approach Cookbook. I'm passionate about nutrient density and the intersection of diet and lifestyle with health, which really means I just love talking about science.
News and Views, where Sarah and I catch up and you get to listen to our gossip. Hello.
How are you?
So when I called you earlier to start this podcast, the first time I accidentally almost called Vivian because I was like thinking it was the other podcast. I'm losing my brain.
Maybe it's because you like talking to Vivian more than me.
I could never choose.
How very diplomatic of you. Oh, well, did you see I actually put together an actual show?
How many times are you going to say actual?
Actually, a few more times.
All right. Well, you know what I did see? Because I have not seen show notes come through yet. Is that we're going on book tour. That's what I saw.
Are you excited?
I am super duper excited, and you should be too.
I am mostly feeling intimidated by traveling so much.
Yeah, I'm trying not to think about that.
It's the airplane every day for 8 straight days thing that's kind of got me going like, oh.
Yeah, so for me, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 days. Yeah. Yeah, it's a bit much. But, you know, even with as many stops as we put, people are already complaining about all the cities that we're not going to. And so I really, really encourage everyone to not do that. Because Sarah and I are human beings, and we have done our very, very best through a lot of hard work and planning to come up with the cities that we...
Flying my mother-in-law out.
Yeah.
In order to be able to do this. And it's still going to be a huge strain on my family.
Yeah.
So I would like people to recognize just how huge this is for us to be doing, like with young kids that we're leaving behind. And that amount of travel is, you know, no matter how much of a support system that you have in place for your kids, it's still a lot of time away from your kids. And, you know, Stacey, for taking time off from your job, I don't know how I'm going to keep up with things like blogging while we're on the road. Like it's going to be fun, and I'm really looking forward to connecting with people and going to the places we're going, but I am not sad that I'm not going more.
Yeah. So, yes, it is a crazy endeavor that we are doing. I think, you know, for a lot of authors who go on book tours, it's their job, and oftentimes they don't have families. So it's a really big deal that we, like you said, are kind of dropping everything and doing this. And the reason that we're doing it is both because we're excited to share our books and to, you know, meet the people who listen to this podcast. Because honestly, when we go do events, it's the people who listen to the podcast that are so closely connected to us, because we're like in your ear every week for 2 years. We get that. But at the same time, you know, it's kind of sad for us and also frustrating when we post something like, you know, coming to Raleigh-Durham, and someone says, you need to come to Charlotte, or you should come to Charlotte. Well, first of all, it's never nice to tell someone what they should or need to be doing. But second of all, like, we're flying all over the country. If the drive for you is 2 hours and it's that important for you, we highly encourage you to come, because we cannot go to every distance in the entire, not just the United States, but we have a lot of international fans that we don't get to visit either. So we can't, like, go to every city 2 hours apart. So we've talked about this before when we talked about book tours, but, like, we haven't even formally announced yet. By the time this airs, we will formally announce, and you can go look up. We'll give you some more information on where you can get details in the information, but, like, it hasn't even been formally announced. And Sarah, I saw in your thread and some of the teaser kind of things that we put out, and people are like, oh, I can't believe you're not coming here. I can't believe you're not coming there. You really need to come here. You should do this, or you should do that. And it's like, can we just all be happy and appreciative of what we have? And it's really unfortunate if we're not making it to your town. I wish we could go to every town, but we are human beings who are doing everything that we possibly can. And it was a really big deal for us to put this tour together. So just encourage everyone to be positive. It
may not have been, like, a huge stress on me to put this together. Yeah. It was a really intense thing for me to commit to. And, yeah, the negativity thing. Not such a big fan. This is, I think, the point of this entire conversation is, let's be positive. There's got to be some cartoon character that says that.
For Shizzle Dizzle, let's be positive. Okay, so moving on to positive things. Let's just give everybody a heads up on where the cities are. And on both Sarah and I's page, we have event links. We're going to be adding it to our sidebar by the time this airs. And I know, Sarah, it's already on your sidebar. And it'll be on all of our social media. And we've talked to you before about making sure that you sign up for our newsletters if you don't want to miss out on anything. I know we'll be putting out a newsletter about it and making sure that we, you know, share any updates or anything along the line through that channel. So we highly encourage you to sign up for both of our newsletters on thepaleomom.com and paleoparents.com. It will literally smack you on the face, sidebar, top bar, anywhere you want to find it. That's where our newsletter is. That's the only way that we know we can get in touch with you.
Can you imagine if you could have, like, a computer, like, something that was actually set to smack people in the face?
Your newsletter announcement's pretty close to it. Anytime I'm on your page, I'm like, oh, I'm already signed up. Go away.
It's supposed to know.
It doesn't know. It doesn't.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay. I have like 18 email addresses, so it probably wants me to sign up with all of them.
Should go away for like a whole month.
No, it doesn't. Because I go to your site like once a week and I see it every time. At least once a week.
Check the settings.
Okay. All right. So our book, Real Life Paleo, releases November 4th. And I was lucky enough to talk Sarah into going on a tour with me, because whenever we do events together, they're a blast and people love us together. And we know that if you're meeting one of us, then you're saying to that person, where's the other person? Like, it just happens.
How often do I get told, like, I wish Stacy was here because I love listening to both of you.
Yeah, exactly. I get the same thing. Or sometimes people even call me Sarah. Like, they don't even know the difference between us.
Yeah, I get called Stacy often.
So we decided that with Sarah having two books come out in the last year and Real Life Paleo coming out, that it was a good time to do a Paleo View live tour. We're calling it the Paleo View book signing tour, but it'll essentially be our podcast live and in person. We'll be doing
going to be recording bits of these. This is my idea.
Sarah can take that on. She's already talking about not knowing how she's going to be blogging, and now she's taking on this project of recording the Paleo View live.
Recording the Paleo View live at these events. Are you kidding me? I have to do this.
It'll be great. I'm sure we will work it out. As long as it's not in the car on a rainy day, it should be fine.
I have the software. We just need the microphone. Matt says he has a microphone.
Yes, we do have
I think we're set.
Yeah. I'll have to fit it in my carry-on bag because it's not very small. But, the first leg of the tour, however, Sarah's going to stay with her family because she was not able to attend the entire ridiculous long length of time that we'll be touring. So the weekend of November 1st and 2nd, Sarah will be in town in Northern Virginia for attending our annual Halloween party on the 1st and then doing a health conference that we are both speaking at on the 2nd. And we will both have book signings, and we're on a panel together, and we each have individual talks on that second day of that health conference. I'm pretty sure it's in Arlington, Virginia. Is that correct?
Yeah, it is.
Okay. And our annual Halloween party is in Fairfax, Virginia. So those are both in Northern Virginia. Then we will have our own book release party of some kind. It probably won't be huge and extravagant, but it will be an official release of some kind, likely in the D.C. or, like, Southern Maryland area, since we're doing two Northern Virginia events on the 4th itself. So once that's done, then Matt and I are hopping on a plane the very next day and kicking off the official on the road tour. We're going to be at Columbus, Ohio, November 5th. We're going to be in Tampa, Florida on November 6th. We're going to be in Raleigh, Durham, North Carolina on November 7th. Sarah will join us, so Matt, Sarah, and I will all be at New York City on November 8th, and then Matt's going to go home and take care of the kids, and Sarah and I are going to finish the tour, so then November 9th, we'll be in Chicago, Illinois. On November 10th, we'll be in Minneapolis, Minnesota. On November 11th, we will be staying with Sarah's family and doing the Atlanta, Georgia leg of the tour. On November 12th, we'll be in Phoenix, Arizona. On November 13th, we'll be in San Diego, California. On November 14th, we'll be in Portland, Oregon. And then Sarah will need to head home, but I will finish out the tour, the very last leg, by myself in Seattle, Washington. Throughout the tour, we anticipate that other bloggers and authors will be joining us at these events. We've heard from a lot of different people that they're going to be coming. I know for a fact that Mickey Trescott will be, Autoimmune Paleo will be at the Portland and Seattle event. And so I'm pretty sure that we'll be picking up some cool kids along the way. But at the very minimum, that's what we're guaranteeing. And you can find out more information, like I said, on our website, and we'll have the link and the image that we've created of the map of the tour on the sidebar of our blogs. So if you have any questions on that. And just as a side note, we are setting up Eventbrites. We highly encourage you to RSVP for those. I know, Sarah, you've talked about that before last week or maybe the week before, about how important it is for bookstores to know how many books to order and for us to kind of be able to plan and also to tell bookstores, yeah, you should sign up Paleo Blogger Authors. We have an awesome fan base and you shouldn't want us to not come to your store. So
the surprising problem,
it's unbelievable how much we have to beg people to sell things for them. So the other part of that equation is that bookstores also want you to buy books with them when they host authors. I think it's a reasonable request. You are welcome to bring in books that you already own for us to sign. But if you're interested in purchasing books, please support the bookstores that are doing us the favor of hosting for these events and purchasing those books in their store. It encourages them to do it again next time. And the better relationship that the publisher has with these bookstores, the easier it is for the next time someone wants to do a signing in your event, in your city. So if you can do those things for us, RSVP, and if you're going to purchase books, do it in the bookstore. It would be greatly appreciated. But of course, if you bring in your dog-eared, well-loved, already cooked in cookbooks, those are our favorites, and we would love to sign those for you as well.
I love it when people have copies of the Paleo Approach that are like completely covered in like bookmarks and post notes. It's like the most fun thing for me to see. So, yeah, just listening to you list all those cities and then knowing like they are in each consecutive days made me feel like it's nap time.
Right. So I hope people understand, like, we're literally going completely around the country.
Like, we are every city a different day. Every single day.
Yeah. So it's kind of intense, and you can see why we can't possibly.
Wait.
What?
I think people should appreciate how much we're going to be radiating our bodies.
Oh, I don't know about you, but I'm planning on going through TSA Quick Check and avoiding that whole thing.
That is not where you get the radiation, but maybe I shouldn't tell you about this.
Yeah, just, I don't need that information.
All right, change of subject. Change of subject.
Well, we all know that traveling is not the best thing for your health. So at the very least, Sarah and I are doing this, and we're, you know, well, by the time we hit halfway through the tour,
we're doing this.
Yeah. By the time we get halfway through the tour, if you show up at an event with organ meat or bone broth, you will definitely get hugs and kisses. So
you'll get those at the beginning of the tour. What are you talking
about?
Don't
tell them that. Don't tell them you give free hugs, because then they won't bring the broth.
Oh, I didn't say anything about kisses.
Okay. What are we doing today?
We're doing an actual show, like in the olden days when we used to do actual shows every week.
I don't even remember what that was like.
I know. The people who have started listening to us in the last, like, 6 months have no clue what the standard format of our show is, because I think we've done, like, 3 in the last 6 months. Maybe we should just change the format of our show. No, I want to go back to, the standard format, because I liked it. So, for new listeners who didn't know that our show had a format, we usually start with this chit-chatty banter announcement-y thing. Every once in a while, there's a soapbox. We usually find out things like, hey, I PR'd my back squat by 25 pounds this morning.
Sweet.
I know. So little details like that. And then we go to a Science with Sarah segment where I'm allowed to be as geeky as I want, which is like my happiest time of the week. And then we answer questions. And what we like to do is we like to kind of keep these shows relatively thematic. So when I'm going through all of the questions, I look for questions that I think have, you know, they're not necessarily always on the same topic, but they have something in common that kind of creates a cohesive discussion. So today's show is really on sort of self-control and challenges, like paleo challenges, and how these things can help, but how they can be really difficult to do. But that being said, Science with Sarah is actually by special request this week. The special request is the massive curiosity on Lacuma powder.
I like that I'm a part of this show so that I get to put my questions to the top of the list.
Yeah, it is like the massive privilege of co-hosting, I think. You have to be like, Sarah, we really didn't cover Lacuma powder yet. I need to know, can I put Lacuma powder in my coffee? So I think that's an excellent segue to Science with Sarah.
Why don't you geek out for us?
Next segment is Science with Sarah, where I take a moment to explain the details and the whys.
So, like, I'm super excited that we actually had Science with Sarah music. It's been a while since we've had Science with Sarah music.
You're geeking out on geeking out. That's pretty cute.
Right. So, I was asked if Lacuma powder is a good sweetener. And this was specifically asked in the context of the autoimmune protocol. But I think we can take a step back and just look at whether or not it's a good choice just as a sugar alternative in the paleo diet. So what lacuma is it's a fruit native to Peru, and lacuma powder is basically the whole fruit is dehydrated and then ground into a powder. And it is rumored to do all kinds of wonderful things. It is, labeled incredibly frequently as a low glycemic index sugar. It's labeled to be good for diabetes, to be good for cardiovascular disease, for blood pressure. There are precisely 2 scientific studies looking at anything to do with lacuma fruit. One looked at the oil from the nut in the middle of the fruit and showed that the oil could improve wound healing. But they really only looked at wound healing from the perspective of the migration of skin cells, a type of cell called fibroblasts, to cover a wound. So they were really looking at it's really membrane dynamics in cells, and that can have a lot to do with the type of fats that are in cells. It turns out that lecithin oil is very, very high in some fats that are known to be healthy. For example, oleic acid, which is an omega-9 monounsaturated fat, and also gamma-linolenic acid, which is known to be really, really important as a anti-inflammatory and for hormones, and can be really, really helpful for people who are dealing with hormone issues. So that may be why, you know, that it's got these healthy fats, and the way that a cell can move when it's a cell that does have that ability is really influenced by the type of fats in its cell membrane. So the type of fats in the cell membrane, because the membrane is made up of fat, really influences the membrane dynamics of the cell. This particular paper didn't go into that level of detail, but that was the way they're approaching it. So they didn't actually measure any effects on the immune system, but generally if you're looking at wound healing, there is an effect on the immune system. There's also usually an effect on angiogenesis, which they only really looked at by measuring nitric oxide, and nitric oxide is produced by an enzyme that is important in angiogenesis, but they really looked at it indirectly. So that's one study on lecuma, and it's not even on the fruit part. It's actually on the oil that is extracted from the seed in the middle. The other study looked at a bunch of different Peruvian fruits and that are sort of traditional diet fruits. Lecuma was found to have a really high phenolic content, which means it has a lot of antioxidants in it. And it was found to be a really, really good inhibitor of alpha-glucosidase activity. And so the paper summarized that that would mean that lecuma fruit would be really, really good for diabetics. So this is what alpha-glucosidase does, is it breaks down complex carbohydrates into glucose as part of carbohydrate digestion in the intestines. So if you inhibit its activity, you don't break down the carbohydrates into glucose, so the glucose is not as easily absorbed. That's why it would be good for diabetics, because you're inhibiting the absorption of glucose. However, these types of digestive enzyme inhibitors are exactly the problems in foods that are leading to overgrowth of bacteria in the intestines. So a small amount of fruit or the whole fruit as part of the whole diet might not be an issue here, but when you start supplementing with things that are really, really high in digestive enzyme inhibitors, you start to have a lot of problems with your ability to absorb nutrients or with the ability to be feeding the gut bacteria at an appropriate level. So that is a red flag for me. This particular study, you know, basically went on to say, you know, it's good for diabetes, maybe good for lowering blood pressure, although the amounts of that was more like the other fruits that they were looking at in terms of their ability to lower blood pressure. It was all done in cell studies. So again, it's really, really hard to draw really direct comparisons between what's going on in, you know, cells grown in a petri dish and what's going on in the human body. But there's some red flags here. I could not find a single study that actually measured the glycemic index of lecuma powder. So it being touted as a low glycemic index sweetener probably comes from this one study showing that it can inhibit alpha-glucosidase activity. However, its glycemic index has not been measured. And actually, the sugars in it are not known. I couldn't find anywhere that actually broke down what types of sugars are in it, whether it's high in sugar alcohols, whether it's high in inulin fiber. There's no information about that out there. And those are things that I would want to know before I started choosing whether or not to consume something on a daily basis. It's not in the USDA database. And when you look at the nutrient facts on packaging of brands that are selling lecuma powder, the amount of carbohydrates and the amount of and what breakdown of carbohydrates there has to be on a nutrient label, which is fiber and sugar, is different from one brand to another. And it shouldn't be that different. If you're if your process is the same and you take the fruit and you dry it and you turn it into a powder, it shouldn't be that different from brand to brand to brand. There's going to be a little bit depending on exactly where they're sourcing it. But for example, one brand where their serving size was 5 grams showed that 4 grams total are carbohydrates. 2 of those grams are fiber. 1 of those grams are sugar. The other gram is mystery, probably starch. Another brand showed that out of a 16-gram serving, 14 grams were total carbohydrates. That's actually pretty similar. 5 of those 14 grams that were carbohydrates were fiber, and 5 grams were sugar. So that's actually a much higher amount of sugar in the second brand. And actually, the one nutrient database that I could find Lucuma powder in showed that 100% of the carbohydrates was sugar, although it wasn't clear at all what the source of that data actually was. So it's actually really, really hard to say whether or not it's low glycemic index. I found the one place where it was in a nutrient database showed the glycemic load was 7, which, you know, grapes are 6, apples are about 6, pineapple is 7. So if the glycemic load really is 7, that's actually pretty high for a fruit. And there are some fruit that are higher. I think papaya is higher and I think mango is higher, but that's a pretty high sugar fruit if the glycemic load is really 7. And it's really unclear how those sugars break down, how much is glucose, how much is fructose, how much is starch, how much might be something that would be worrisome for somebody with FODMAP sensitivity, like high inulin fiber content or high polyols, or whether there's other things that are making Lucuma taste sweet. Like in stevia, there's steviols, which are a plant hormone, that are making it taste sweet. But then, of course, because it has a hormone structure, it can have all kinds of other effects that are related to human hormones. And there's some potential hormonal effects in humans that are a reason to be wary of using stevia. This is not known in Lucuma powder. So the big question, is it a good sweetener? I mean, there's just not enough information to go by that's out there that is reputable information. And so for me, I'm not going to go out and buy it. That was basically my summary of like, wow, we really know nothing about it. Might have some antioxidants, might prevent digestion of carbohydrates. There's lots of antioxidants I can get elsewhere that aren't going to have that effect. So generally, if, you know, generally when it comes to sugar substitutes, every time you look at a non-sugar, so like a non-sucrose sugar substitute, there's a health detriment. There's a price to pay. And it really comes back to the fact that you cannot cheat sugar. There is no sugar substitute. There's no way to taste sweet and for it to not have a detrimental impact on the body. And in fact, our bodies have a far greater capacity to handle real sugar, sucrose, mixes of sucrose, glucose, and fructose, like you would find in cane sugar or in honey or in molasses or in actual fruit. Our bodies have a far greater capacity to handle that, provided the dose is reasonable, than they have to handle any sugar substitute. And so when it comes to like, what am I going to put in my coffee? Can I put Lucuma powder? My answer is, I mean, we're all individuals and it's always worth individual experimentation. But my first recommendation is try to get used to coffee without sweeteners. And my second is, and work on lowering the amount that you're putting in. But if you absolutely have to have that coffee, and I don't know why that would be, and you absolutely have to put some kind of sweetener in it, and I also don't know why that would be. But if that was, you know, the absolute, you know, the law that you were going to have coffee and it was going to have sweetener in it, my recommendation would be to put in some kind of unrefined but natural sweetener, like molasses would actually be my top preference. Molasses is surprisingly good with coffee because it has, and molasses would be my top preference because it has such dense mineral content. But if you're not going to do molasses, an unrefined cane sugar or maple syrup or honey, those would be, I think, the best choices that are going to have the least amount of impact on the human body. And if you're diabetic and you say, well, I can't have those kinds because I'm diabetic, then you should not be putting sugar into coffee. Whoa.
I would also suggest, while we're talking about what to do, one of the other things that I pay attention to when I'm eating sweetened foods is making sure that it's accompanied with either protein or fat so that it's not like a straight insulin response.
And fiber too. Fiber will also slow down quickly it's absorbed. Yeah.
So, you know, if you're eating an almond meal-based treat, there's going to be a whole bunch of nutrients and both micronutrients and macronutrients that will help your body not just have a straight sugar shot. That's not to say that you should run out and eat all the paleo treats, but it's a little bit different from, let's say, a donut, which is made with wheat flour, which is a refined carbohydrate, as well as sugar. So when you eat something like a donut, it's almost 100% straight to your blood sugar, whereas if you eat something like a paleo donut that's made with almond flour and eggs and honey or maple syrup, then it's your body has a higher tolerance to dealing with that sugar load that you're giving it because of the other things that accompany that sugar load. So, you know, when my children eat an apple, like, let's not even talk about donuts. Let's just talk about something from a simple fact. Like, when my children eat fruit, I highly encourage them to do it with something that has usually fat, if not protein, or both in it. So, like, my kids are used to being served an apple with sun butter or almond butter. It's more satiating for them and it helps kind of manage blood sugar. And there are a lot of like coconut milk type treats or coconut based treats that's going to be higher in fat that can do the same kind of thing if you can't do nuts. So just from my personal experience and how I've, you know, kind of morphed the way we live our lives over the last 4 years is I pay attention not just to the type of sweetener, but also kind of what's accompanying it so that I can think through how is it going to affect our bodies.
Yep.
Well, speaking of that, I really want to talk about how...
You're like reading ahead because you haven't actually looked at the questions. You're like, wait a minute, I'm trying to come up with a segue.
So for me, Matt asked what the show was tonight, and we're sitting at dinner table next to each other. Usually we sit across from each other, and he says to me like, oh, what are you guys gonna podcast about tonight? And I was like, self-control. And he looked at me and just started laughing. Like, because they're next to each other, like doing the shoulder push thing, like, oh, you jerk. And I pushed him and then he starts laughing at me and like slapping his leg. And it's like this big thing. And I was like, yeah, I mean, part of what we're going to talk about is a lack thereof, I'm sure. So yeah. While we're on the topic of sweets, I think that's where I was trying to segue with. This is my problem with self-control.
This is kind of why I thought this was actually a good Science with Sarah segment to have in this show, because one of the things that happens when you are making a change to your diet or you have lifestyle factors that are causing cravings and you're, you know, forcing yourself into a position where you need to exert a lot of self-control, one of the natural tendencies is to look for cheats, right? Look for, you know, where can I bend the rules? Where can I have something that tastes sweet but isn't going to qualify as one of these like illegal foods I'm not supposed to eat? And I think this is, it's, you know, human nature to sort of, you know, bend rules and see what we can get away with. So, I think we've got some good questions to talk about.
Sweet. Let's do it. Questions and Answers, where we answer questions submitted by you through the contact form on our websites, paleomom.com and paleoparents.com.
Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
So our first question is from Liz. So Liz saw on Facebook that Stacey had started a whole life challenge. We talked about this relatively recently. On the podcast, and that you mentioned, Stacey, that it was a good fit for your family and for you, considering your past with disordered eating. So Liz writes, she shares a bit of her history, and then she writes, throughout this year, I've had some major food issues. I've tried some 21-day sugar detoxes, 30-day challenges throughout the past year in an attempt to regain my health. I eat things I know are not helping, as well as the amount of caffeine I drink, 2 to 3 cups a day, and way too much sugar. My ND wants me to do an elimination diet very similar to the autoimmune protocol, and I have tried 2 times to do it. Every time I attempt to do a challenge of any kind, I last about 5 days, and then I fail miserably. It's almost as if it's worse than when I started. I know I'm allergic to milk and gluten and quite possibly corn, but I just can't get those things out of my diet. I want to have a healthy relationship with food, and I know my health depends on these foods being removed. However, how can I approach it, especially when it's my doctor prescribing it, where it doesn't make my disordered eating worse? Any tips would help. Thanks in advance.
This is really intense for me to read. I actually saw this when it came in originally and like wanted to respond, but had hoped that we would be able to address it in a more thorough way. So for me, I think there's 2 issues going on here. I think for me, the way that I approach it and the way that I think about it is that I went on an autoimmune protocol to change my health because I was having a health crisis and I had to change my health. You know, I have a family, I have a life, and I want my life to be as long, as happy, as healthy as it can possibly be. And I knew that there were things that I was doing, eating, consuming, that were contributing to my not being at my ideal health. Now, granted, there's things that I eat on a daily basis or a weekly basis where I know that it's not contributing to my health, but it's different to say that this is actively destroying my health. And I knew from knowing Sarah so much and from knowing my own autoimmune disorders that I had to step up and remove these foods so that I could try to heal my body and live a healthy, longer life. That's the framework by which I followed AIP. I did not consider AIP a 30-day challenge or an elimination diet. Like, I didn't think, even though it is an elimination diet, I think that there's an association with elimination diet where you think, oh, I'm just removing these things for 30 days and then I can have them again. And it's like this taunting carrot hanging over your face, and you're just like, I want it, I want it, I want it. Rather than the mindset that I had to have, which was, I no longer eat tomatoes because they make me sick. And it's kind of, you know, we've talked about this mindset before about, you know, not eating birthday cake in the office. Like, instead of saying, no, I can't eat that, when you say, no, I don't eat that, or no, I'm choosing not to eat that, there's a completely different mindset that you yourself feel when you say those words. And I think it's really important that you apply that same kind of structural relationship when you're talking about needing for your health to remove these foods. It's not a whole 30. It's not a 21-day sugar detox. That is healing yourself. And if a doctor's telling you that this is something you need to do, then I would really remove them from your house, surround yourself with positive people, listen to this podcast every day for the next, you know, however many months that you need to do this. Read blog posts, write blog posts, write a journal, talk to friends, find a community of people that support you. I know Sarah has the Paleo Mom community website. There's also an AIP Facebook group. There's tons and tons of social media resources that you can immerse yourself in if you don't have any physical support to succeed in this. And I know that I personally cried and had temper tantrums several times doing AIP, even when I had been clean paleo for like 2 years or whatever at that point. I still struggled to remove the autoimmune protocol foods because it meant I couldn't eat out. I couldn't have, at the time, I don't think Epic Bars were out. So there was like nothing that I could eat that was like on the go because everything had paprika in it. And when you're out and about in the town, everything has canola oil in it or butter in it. And I couldn't have those things in AIP. So I know how very, very frustrating it is. But I also know that I made a commitment to myself and my family and my health that I wanted to be there for them and be there for myself in the long run. And it wasn't even an option for me. So in that mindset of AIP and health, like, that's how I think. the reason that I personally find the whole life challenge more appropriate for me than, let's say, a Whole 30 or a 21-day sugar detox is because it really focuses on making the best choices that you can at the time and then moving on. Literally, you get a different kind of score sheet the next day. So if you, like me, went to a birthday party on Sunday and you made this gorgeous birthday cake for a friend and you lick your fingers from stirring the icing and then you're like, ah, the heck with it. I'm going to eat a slice of cake. And it's a paleo cake, but paleo cakes are not acceptable on the Whole Life Challenge. So then I mark myself for not meeting my nutritional needs, but then I also feel really good when I'm able to say, yes, I exercised. Yes, I mobilized. Yes, I did this lifestyle challenge where I appreciated, you know, that the things that I'm grateful for in my life, and I wasn't distracted by using my phone, and I drank my water, and I had nutrient-dense foods today. So overall, instead of getting 15 points, I get 13 points, but that's awesome. I did 13 things great today and only did 2 things not great today. And then the next day I'm able to say, I am not going to eat cake today because that cake's at that person's house and I don't even have it in my house and it's not here and I don't worry about it. And the other thing that I really liked about it is that the things that I personally struggle with from and disordered eating mentality are if someone tells me something is like off the plate that doesn't logically work for me in terms of nutrients or how they contribute to my health, I have a really difficult time with that. So for me, when the Whole 30 says things like egg crepes replicate a tortilla, even if it's just coconut flour and eggs, and I know that those are two healthful things, if they say because it looks like a tortilla, I can't have it, that makes me have problems in my brain. And I don't know how to describe that other than it makes it be like this game for me where I'm like, oh, you say I can't have this, and then I really want it, and then it becomes like this antagonistic thing that I'm playing with myself rather than focusing on the positive and the healthy and the really great things. And I think for me, a 21-day sugar detox just, I like fruit, and I find that if I'm able to reasonably have, you know, apples when they're in season, not green apples, because the 21-day sugar detox does allow green apples, but, you know, if I want berries, then I don't feel bad that I'm having berries, because I know that berries are high in antioxidants, and they're micronutrient-rich, and they offer vitamin C, and there's, you know, not a ton of really bad things about berries. I've done a 21-day sugar detox several times. It doesn't necessarily create disordered eating for me. I feel like where I am in my paleo journey, those kinds of foods don't set me off to wanting different kind of sweet foods. Like, I don't have a problem eating fruit and then saying, oh, I want a, you know, real brownie. Like, it satiates me. So I like that the Whole Life Challenge allows both, you know, foods that look like cookies, even if they're fruit sweetened, and fruit. Like those are the two things that are important to me. It's basically like how I live my paleo life 100% of the time, but it's just holding me accountable to kind of think about it on a daily basis and put it in and be in a community of people who are also thinking about it and, you know, high-fiving one another for good things that they do or encouraging people to get back on the wagon if they have a bad day. And those things are worked well for me, and it could, you know, be different things for different people. But I would say in this person's particular case, it's not the time for a challenge or some sort of short-term result. I think those things are more associated with diet and not with lifestyle. And I think from what the health kind of things that she's living with and where she's trying to go, it's much more about health and lifestyle than it is about diet. I was the longest answer ever. I told you why I didn't email her back.
No, it was a really good answer. So the only thing I'm going to add is, you know, one of the things that I like to tell people when they are trying to figure out how they're going to change their diet is that it's really important to respect and honor you as a person and what is the method that you use to affect change in your life most successfully. And for some people, that means you jump in with both feet. And if you're going to jump in with both feet, you want to set yourself up for success by, you know, cleaning out your pantry, making sure those foods aren't around, you know, all of those things. Other people do better with taking baby steps, and maybe it's going to be a, you know, more sustainable change to make a plan for yourself, you know, a plan that, you know, when you're talking about, you know, having, you know, allergy to milk and gluten and corn and not even being able to get those things out of your diet, but your ND wants you to do this super strict elimination diet, you know, maybe the baby steps are getting rid of gluten and milk and corn and doing that first, and then tackling the other foods that your ND wants you to eliminate, and setting up, you know, even a schedule for yourself if you think that would help, or if you do it a lot more organically and you basically move on to the next step as soon as you feel like you've got the previous step down. But some people do much, much better taking this kind of major transition. I mean, this is a major change for us to make in our lives, to completely revamp our diets. Many people do better taking it in baby steps. And it's what's most important is that you're able to make these changes and make them sustainably. And if you're dealing with crazy, you know, cravings and feelings of deprivation, and you're having to use all of this huge amount of self-control in order to be able to even do this for 5 days, that's not sustainable. And so, you know, honor yourself, respect yourself. If you do better with baby steps, then figure out a plan for how to do this in baby steps. And just figure out, you know, the most important thing is that you get there. And so figuring out what path you're going to take is, you know, what you need to do now. But it's okay if you're not going to do it as a challenge. It's okay if you're going to do it as step by step and, you know, focusing on sort of the probably most problematic foods first, and then, you know, going from there. So I'm giving permission to people to transition slowly is what I'm doing, because I think it works better for many, many people.
Irony. I think I wrote a book or two about that.
Maybe. Just saying. There's a new book coming out that everyone's going to want to get called Real Life Paleo.
It will outline those things for you. But certainly if you know, like Sarah said, if you know that you have a response to certain foods, like for example, in Real Life Paleo, corn is not removed until phase two. But I would say if you know that you have a reaction to corn, I would include those foods. And this is just a general statement for everybody to kind of, the point is to get out the most offensive foods in the phase one. So if you know that you have a problem with that, then definitely I agree with Sarah in terms of making sure that you remove that in your first step, because you're going to get the most bang for your buck, and that'll encourage you to continue doing what you're doing, the more positive results you see. So
there's something else probably worth mentioning. One of the reasons that jumping in with both feet can be really, really difficult is it can be quite a challenge to our hormone systems, and it can be quite a challenge to our neurotransmitters, and it can be quite a challenge to our metabolism. And in all of those cases, the challenge is magnified in the context of not getting enough sleep and being under stress. And so one of the greatest tips for getting through a transitional period and getting to the point where your body has a more flexible metabolism and where your neurotransmitters, you know, re-regulate themselves, is to actually get extra sleep during those transitions. And whether that, you know, really is, can be helpful, whether you're doing it in baby steps or doing it as sort of jumping in with both feet. But really working on getting tons of sleep and making sure that stress is well managed can be really, really helpful in terms of reducing those cravings and that sense of deprivation and just the whole emotional side of it. We have a much better capacity to handle change when we are well rested.
Yeah. It's interesting. I found this article on Rob Wolf's site when I was trying to figure out how to manage my own life and difficulty with carbohydrates. And I was like, oh, I really wish I'd like seen this beforehand. And it was basically spoke to a little bit of what you just said, where he found some scientific papers, research indicating that the reduction in carbohydrates from a drastic perspective can have metabolic impacts in a very negative way long term. And so if you're going to reduce your carbohydrates, and almost anybody going on a standard American diet to a paleo diet, even if you're eating a quote-unquote high-carb paleo diet, is still going to be low-carb compared to most standard American diets. So his thought on the process was to kind of wean yourself off of those carbohydrates, even if it's like 5 grams a day, so that your system is kind of, your metabolism is able to figure out what you're doing and slowly adapt to it. And I thought that was fascinating thought process. And there were some people that talked about how when they reintroduced carbohydrates, they had some bloating and some issues that, you know, were uncomfortable, but it did help them kind of performance and hormone regulation. And then he had people reintroduce them 5 grams at a time, and those people didn't have the bloating and negative response, but still had the positive response of hormone regulation and improvement. So I think that when you are doing, as Sarah describes, kind of a slower approach, it can have long-term benefits, whereas we like to say, yes, if you just give it 30 days and try it, you will see health benefits, of course. But what we're learning, everybody, all the time, is in metabolism is very, the body and the hormones, how they play with one another, are a very complex system. And so the more that you kind of make drastic changes all in once, yes, if you have food intolerances to those things, or if for whatever reason your body wants to get rid of those foods, you're going to see a positive response from that. What you might not realize until later is that, you know, your metabolism or your other hormones didn't adjust properly. And then, you know, trying to reintroduce them, or going too low carb for long term, we've talked about that, you know, it all has its own repercussions. So this question just opened a whole bag of worms. I think we can officially call this a soapbox, but I think that it summarizes a lot of the questions that we get frequently, and some of Sarah and I's own experiences, and hopefully our answers are more helpful than confusing, but who knows at this point.
Okay, so here's a related question from Megan, who has issues with compulsive eating and is trying to follow the autoimmune protocol, but is having a lot of binges currently. Have either of you ever been to Overeaters Anonymous? I feel so much better when I am autoimmune protocol, but I keep eating things I know are bad for me. I have to address my issues with food before I can heal myself.
I think that's a really great idea. I personally did not attend, probably should have or should attend. I have talked before in a previous podcast, maybe if Monica can find it, she'll put a link in the show notes to how I addressed bulimia. And when I went to therapy, they addressed the throwing up part, but they never addressed the binging part. And so that never really stopped for me for a really long time. And I used to binge on, you know, ridiculous amounts of food that would make me feel sick. I'm still an emotional eater, but I am not a binger. I think I've learned to love and respect my body enough at this point to know that food can have an emotional impact on me. And I try to be really aware of that, and I try to not make those choices. And sometimes in the moment of, you know, one third of a way through a giant bowl of Froyo, I say to myself, this is not the best choice. And I stand up and I throw the rest away. So I think I've kind of had my own personal therapy. That's not to say that I think that Overeaters Anonymous wouldn't be a good idea, or even just therapy in general, to get to the root of what it is that's causing the binging or the overeating, because usually it's an emotional or a mental trigger of some capacity. So I think that group is supportive for other people who have the same problem, but oftentimes individuals figuring out what that issue for themselves is can be very helpful.
That was a really good answer. I also have never been to Overeaters Anonymous. I don't think I actually recognized that I was a binge eater until I was kind of on the other side and had sort of mostly figured out how to not do it. And so it's sort of hard to go in seek of help when you don't realize you have a problem. And I really didn't. I had a lot of excuses. And it wasn't until I was reflecting back on how I used to eat that I really realized that that was binging. I still have, compulsion is kind of a strong word, but I still will have this sort of, again, it's always a response to stress and it's always when I am tired. So it's always when I'm not looking after myself from a lifestyle perspective, but that I will have this, I guess, compulsion to eat something sweet, I guess is the best way to put it. Although it's a little bit different than compulsive eating where it gets to a point where you're sort of doing it without having control, because I do have control over that behavior, and it becomes something that I then can make a conscious decision about whether or not I'm going to indulge in the, you know, with that craving or not. And the foods that I choose are not optimal foods. They're foods that I know, you know, aren't the best choices for me, but they are also foods that are still paleo foods that are, you know, don't have any of the things that I know I'm highly sensitive to them in. So for example, it would be very common for me, you know, if I'm stressed, I'm tired, to have this, you know, craving for something sweet, and I would have fruit, or I would have a popsicle that's just made with blended up fruit, or I would have a little bit of dark chocolate. I mean, those are the things that I will go to sort of satisfy that craving. And they're very, very healthy choices. Would I be better if I didn't eat, you know, 3 servings of fruit in one sitting? Yes. But for me, it's always what I try to look at it as, is not that the problem isn't that I just had 3 pieces of fruit all in one sitting, and that's a pretty large amount of fruit for my body to have all at once, but that it, for me, it's always a red flag that I'm not getting enough sleep, that my stress level's, you know, too high, and that I need to work on those lifestyle factors. As soon as I start working on those lifestyle factors, those cravings and compulsions go away. And so figuring out where the emotional link to food is where, you know, a group like Overeaters Anonymous can help with, or, you know, a therapist or somebody in that sort of style profession may be able to help with. But I also think that there's clearly a physiological response as well that is causing that compulsion. We know that there's a variety of factors that can be really, really diet factors that can be really, really helpful in depression, and seem to be really helpful in addiction in general. So a high omega-3 intake, for example, has been shown to be therapeutic in recovering alcoholics. I would assume that recovering overeaters would be very, very similar. A really, really nutrient-dense diet. A lot of antioxidants. So we know that part of what's going on here in addiction is inflammation in the brain. So eating a very antioxidant rich diet can be really helpful. And then the stress reduction, meditation, walking, being outside, being in nature, getting plenty of sleep. Those things are also really helpful in recovering from other forms of addiction. So those would be places that I'd be looking at either first or in conjunction with, I mean, depending on where you feel you are in your health journey and what level of help that you feel that you need. But there are other things to keep in mind that go beyond, you know, working through the emotional attachment to food and figuring out the emotional root causes of overeating.
Agreed.
Okay, so we have mentioned, well, I have mentioned, I brought it up twice, sleep. So this is why I thought this last question would be a really good one, and it's from Teresa. And her question is about tracking sleep. She writes, my husband got me a Fitbit this past January, and the function that I really have been using is the sleep tracker. Do you have any idea how accurate they are? More than anything, though, I'd love to hear your opinions on tracking devices like these and if they have any value.
Well, far be it for me to say what's of value to somebody else. I ended up getting a Fitbit. I wasn't a huge fan of it. I know that they have an upgraded version now. I ended up getting something called a Withings Pulse at the time because I wanted something that could take my heartbeat. And I found it valuable insofar as I was really interested in the results for about a week or two. And then I learned, then I kind of learned what my rhythms and my patterns were, and it was a self-educated kind of thing. And then I was like, okay, not really interested anymore. I know that I need to walk more. So I got a standing desk, and I know that I sleep really well once I'm asleep, so I just needed to sleep earlier. And I knew that my heartbeat was exactly what it should have been in terms of both resting and active. And so I had the heartbeat of like a professional athlete. And so I was like, oh, okay, these pretty much mirror exactly what I thought, and that's great. If they hadn't mirrored what I thought, it could have given me some information on things that I needed to tweak. In my personal experience, I don't think that those sleep trackers are very good because all they do, most of them, is measure non-movement. And so you could lay perfectly still and it say that you're sleeping and you don't sleep. So, like, I knew for a fact that I'd had one night where I had a difficult time falling asleep. I wasn't tossing and turning. I just knew that I wasn't falling asleep because I was watching the clock. And the next day, it told me I had been asleep. And I was like, that's kind of unfortunate. But it will measure, and for a lot of people, this is helpful, especially if you have, like, sleep apnea or if you wake up tired. Something like that would be helpful insofar as it's going to tell you how often you're having movement and disruption in your sleep. So for me, once I'm asleep, I'm a really, really solid sleeper. And so it was nice to see that I don't have any sleeping issues anymore. I used to have terrible apnea that Matt thought I was going to literally suffocate myself in my sleep. And it's not an issue for me anymore. So I'm really talkative today. You go ahead, Sarah.
So I have never obtained one of these devices or tracked my sleep. I have an iPhone and I just downloaded iOS 8. Well, I guess I downloaded it like right away. I just downloaded the updated, not so buggy version, which makes me very, very happy. But part of new iOS 8 is this health app that can assemble data from a bunch of different apps. And it's got some sort of highlighted apps that are really good at sort of interfacing with it, one of which is a sleep app. And I was actually looking at it with my husband yesterday and kind of going like, well, how does it work? Like, how is it measuring sleep? And what you actually do is you put your phone in your bed with you, or you can strap it like on your arm. And again, it measures movement. So it uses the accelerometer that's in your iPhone, and it's just tracking your movement. But I looked at that and went, like, I very, very purposefully leave my phone downstairs in the kitchen when I go to bed, and I do not want to be bringing my phone to bed with me. You know, I think that these types of devices in general, whether you are tracking sleep or you're tracking steps or you're tracking, you know, hours of activity, or you're using it as a nutrient tracker, you know, I think that there's some utility in them in terms of figuring out where you're at. And I think that a lot of these apps are very, very clever in devising a reward system so that there's some kind of reward for doing well. And whether that's, you know, I've got, you know, this health app that comes with the iPhone, it's called Human, and it tells me how many, you know, how much time I've spent during the day being active or walking or running or biking or in a car. And it gives me these little messages when I hit, you know, when I hit half an hour, I hit an hour of activity, and it's like, you're doing a great job. Like, way to go. And it's sort of this reward system built in. But at the same time, for me personally, I'm probably not about to go for a walk around my neighborhood in the evening in order to meet some kind of milestone on my pedometer. If I want to go for a walk around my neighborhood in the evening, it's because I want to go for a walk around my neighborhood in the evening and because I find that to be a relaxing thing to do. So these reward systems in some ways defer us from the real goal of being active or the real goal of prioritizing sleep. And they give us these rewards that are really, they're not worth anything. They don't actually, I mean, the reward for these types of activities should be how you feel when you do these types of activities. And so for some people, I think that, you know, having an interactive app or an interactive device where you can track it and you can, you know, have this like badge of honor that I did 20,000 steps today or whatever it is that's your goal. I think for some people, it can work really, really well to motivate them to have healthy habits. But I think that, you know, again, as we were talking about, you know, respecting the type of person that you are, for me, doing those healthy habits is because of how good I feel when I'm doing them or when I'm done them. And I don't want to change that motivation to be, you know, that I got a little heart badge on my app. I want it the motivation to still be because I feel good when I do them. And that's me personally. And that doesn't mean that this isn't a useful tool for someone else. And certainly, you know, there's some utility to being able to gauge, you know, well, I think I'm sleeping well, but am I sleeping well? And then you can have this, you know, Fitbit or whatever it is tell you that actually you move around a lot in your sleep and your sleep's really disrupted. And then you can start to troubleshoot why your sleep's disrupted and you can use your Fitbit to give you, you know, more information about how your sleep is as you're trying to troubleshoot. But I think there's some utility in them, but this movement towards tracking everything, in some ways I feel like it creates a new stress because it creates this, you know, yet another thing that's telling us what to do and yet another thing that's sort of drawing our attention away from just, you know, being in our bodies and being in our lives and enjoying our lives. I think it's, you know, I think that, you know, going for a walk in the evening because you like to go for a walk in the evening is, I think you will enjoy that and it will have a better impact on your emotional health than if you go for a walk in the evening because your Fitbit told you that you need to go get, you know, 5,000 more steps for the day. And so I think that all of these things kind of wrap in together. And I think that doesn't mean that these aren't great tools for some people. But as a general rule, I don't see it having a huge amount of functionality in my life. That being said, I have said things before on this very podcast that I have completely turned around and changed my opinion on years later. For example, I used to not like kidneys, and now they're one of my favorite organs.
And so, now you say some American words correctly. I mean, what's wrong with you?
I know, I say progress now. I don't understand what's happening to me. I'm changing. I'm getting older is what's happening.
So the other thing that I want to add about what I ended up finding myself doing, if I'm being completely honest about the Fitbit and the Withings thing, is that the steps are measured like on your wrist. This is the most ineffective way to measure steps, like, of all time, in my opinion. And I may or may not, on days where I didn't have enough steps, just shook my wrist a whole lot. So for those of us who are a little rebellious and who like to find every way possible to beat the system, this sort of device will not work for you.
Right. That
just would be, saying.
Yeah, not the intended outcome. So what do we think? We think it may work for some people, not for us. You've actually tried it.
I still have it upstairs in a drawer not being used. The kids really enjoyed it too. Like they took it, they all wore it for a few days and they had way more steps than me. It's like, all right, cool, you're active. Like,
I was looking at this app and going, like, if I'm not going to strap the phone to my person, which I don't want to do, and I'm just going to have it in the bed beside me, then it's going to be measuring like our joint sleep, like my sleep and my husband's sleep. And then the whole point of this app is it's supposed to learn. Now, this is kind of cool. It's supposed to learn your sleep patterns, so it wakes you up at the right phase in your sleep so that it's a less disruptive wakening than an alarm that just goes off at a specific time. That's kind of an interesting idea, but I'm pretty sure it'll always wake me up when my husband should wake up, because things just work that way for me, and I don't want to do that.
Yeah. Cool, man. We had an official show. And
a real show.
It was pretty timely, if I do say so myself.
Excellent. Well, for anybody who's listening on Friday or Saturday morning who lives in the state of Pennsylvania, I am...
I almost did a little Dracula thing there for you. Sorry.
Did you? Thanks, ma'am. I'm going to be giving a 2-hour-long seminar in Biglerville. And you can get all of the information on that by going to thepaleomom.com/events. I think the tickets are like $8.50 for the whole event, which is ridiculous because when I do seminars, it's usually $50 to $75 per person. Granted, this is a little bit shorter than what my seminars normally are, but this is like a huge deal. So if you're anywhere in the area, that's a cool way to come out and meet me, and there'll be books for sale there, and I'll be signing books as well. And I won't be seeing you, Stacey, even though I'll be like... half an hour from your house.
I'm sorry. I know you want to come over and do the hot tub. I mean, you're welcome to come over and stay here. We just won't.
You just won't be there. I'm going to be hanging out with Angie Alt from Alternative Autoimmune, and we're going to be having a lot of fun.
Who we peer pressured to get on Instagram, by the way.
Is she on Instagram now?
Yeah. I don't know how, because she has like a phone from the 70s, like a flip phone. It's not even a razor, though. Like, we're giving her a hard time about it, and evidently we peer pressured her successfully enough that she's on Instagram now. Because I was like, that's where the cool kids hang out. You gotta come over.
Well, I'm looking forward to hanging out with her, and I will see if I can get more details about her Instagram plans.
Cool. Well, I can't look forward to seeing all of the people that we will get to meet and visit with on our tour. We're doing... almost all new cities, which Sarah and I purposely did. I know that we're not hitting Northern California. We unfortunately couldn't do Denver. I really wanted to do Denver, but Sarah's already doing Denver, I think, 2 weeks from now. One week from this airs.
From the time this airs, I will actually be in Denver. I'm in Denver on October 11th. And again, thepaleomom.com/events will get you all the information. And I'm super excited because I have never actually been outside of the Denver airport. I've been in Denver in the airport only. And it's so beautiful. Like even, you know, like the airport view is gorgeous. So I can't wait to actually like leave the airport and see some of the city. I'm planning on dropping into Coffee and checking it out. The Paleo restaurant in Denver. And
I thought about joining you, but I have a thing that I can't not do that weekend.
A thing?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Can't do it because of the thing with the thing.
It's like kids, family, obligations, blah, blah.
Womp, womp.
Womp, womp. Cool. So, awesome. We're doing some book tours. You're finally hearing us be cheery. We're celebrating our books instead of complaining about them. I get to hold a copy of Real Life Paleo on October 16th. I'm super, super stoked about it. And so that means that the printer will actually print my ginormous book, and you will eventually get it in your hand. I highly encourage everyone to go pre-order a copy of Real Life Paleo if you've not yet done so. Because Lord knows what kind of problems they're going to have. But if you put your pre-order in right now, it's like $23 for a $40 book. You can't beat that. And you can only get that price guaranteed if you pre-order it. So do that. And while you're there, if you haven't already purchased or left a review for The Paleo Approach, The Paleo Approach Cookbook, Beyond Bacon or Eat Like a Dinosaur, we'd really appreciate it. If you did that, because reviews help other people find our books. And last but not least, if you haven't yet already given this podcast a review in iTunes. We really, really would appreciate you doing that as well. We've been getting great traffic and interest, and the more that people share that with other people by, you know, spreading the word and leaving good reviews, the more we can help other people find health and happiness.
Aw, that sounds like a really nice note to end on.
Awesome.
Well, thanks for listening, everybody.
We'll be back next week.
Thank you for listening to The Paleo View. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.
All right, a real show in the bag.
And we pimped ourselves. That's not appropriate for Blooper Matthew.
Yes, yes, yes it is.
Oh my God.
Best blooper